Welcome to Command Control Power, a weekly podcast hosted by three certified members of the Apple Consultants Network, drawing from over 30 years combined experience. We talk shop, interview vendors and colleagues, and share what we've learned while operating our technology consulting practices. This is Joe Saponari of CIMAC, and my two co-hosts are Sam Valencia of the HCS Technology Group and Jerry Zygmunt of MacWorks. We are live at commandcontrolpower.com, the first Tuesday of every month, where new episodes are posted weekly. Thanks for listening. We are very honored to be joined this week by Tom Bridge, partner at Technolutionary in Washington, D.C. Tom, you've been on, I think, once before, so welcome back to Command Control Power.
Once before. Twice.
Many maybe?
Times. No, he did one with just Sam and I.
Oh, and, see, and I Tom, so and, I Tom and I this, had dinner together.
Yeah, this is like, right, yeah. Like Tom's fourth appearance on the show.
Oh,
Sleeping Joe.
You might have just won as Command Control Power, Tom.
Won something.
Well, well done. You're the maybe the winningest guest of Command Control Power, possibly. But in any case, welcome back for the third or fourth or fifth time to Command Control Power, Tom.
It's always great to be on with you guys. Thank you so much for inviting me tonight.
So I think this came about because we got into the weeds a little bit on a cabling discussion live. Sam had a story about something he walked into at his buddy's restaurant, right, Sam? Where you had some cabling difficulties and you saved the day by bringing your cabling kit and, you know, re-crimping some connectors. And we sort of got off on a discussion about why was this drop working, I guess, with one device and not with another device. And we were kind of speculating on that. And you sort of raised your hand and said, I need to clarify some things here.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I've been crimping cables since I was in high school. And just for clarity, that was 20 or some years ago. Because what we would do is that, you know, we had a house full of Macs at my folks' place, kind of run them all together to play Marathon, usually. And nice. So I have a couple of people over and, you know, fire up Marathon across the network, which was, you know, really the first solid multiplayer first-person shooter game for the Mac. And that required Ethernet to do. And so my dad taught me how to, you know, create and crimp a proper 10 base T cable back in like 1993, I think, 92 maybe. And, you know, I've been doing it ever since. And it was funny because there are still bad days when I'm just like Mr. Butterfingers and I can't make a good cable to save my life. But a couple of years ago, our cabling contractor that we work with all the time at work just making up patch cords because we had some time to spare before sound check. We were just making up a couple of 50-foot patch cables.
That's what I do in my spare time.
Yeah. We were setting up for the Foo Fighters concert a couple years ago when they played at RFK Stadium here in D.C.
Feeling dumb now, Sam?
Yeah, I'm feeling kind of stupid now.
And so we were making 50-foot patch cables in case we had to run cable to a terminal someplace where we weren't expecting to have it. And so, you know, he showed me his trick for this, and I still need to make it a video. I haven't done it yet. My thing is that all I have are sitting around the house are pre-made cables, and pre-made cables are kind of crappy for making patch cables because they use slightly different – they use, as JD pointed out the other day, they use stranded wire, which is great if you're doing – like it's a great way to make a cheap cable if you're a cable making company and you want to make a whole bunch of 1 foot, 3 foot, 5 foot, 7 foot, 12 foot, you know, 20 foot cables. But if you really want a long run, you want a solid strand of copper throughout the whole thing. And so, you know, we're sitting there with boxes of cable making 50-foot cables, and he showed me his trick. And essentially what it amounts to is you kind of work with your non-dominant hand as like a vise grips, and you kind of use your thumb and your index finger to kind of hold the cable in place. You remove the outer shield out of the outer sheathing. And shielding, if it's a longer shielded cable, or if it's got there are a couple of all weather cables that have like goo in there, so that the cables don't freeze, or that they freeze the right way, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You put that cable in there, and then you kind of sprint. You kind of roll it back in your hands, roll it back between your thumb and your index finger to kind of fan out the existing wire, and then you kind of unpair the four sets of twisted pair that are in there, and then you kind of, you know, it's kind of like braiding somebody's hair. You kind of you arrange the braids in the direction that you want to go, and you kind of tamp them down with your index finger and your thumb, and then you kind of make a clean cut that's about, I don't know, about an inch or so out in front of the shielding. And then that's what you use. You never let go of the cable again after you make that trim. And so then you just slide the end on just like that, and all the cables never have a chance to move again. Because that's always the thing, right? We're always in a hurry. And you're trying to get the end on there, and you end up with like two of them in swapped. Or if it's my case, it's always the green and the blue in pins 3 and 4 end up switching places. If there's a cable that doesn't pass, that's the pair that's always reversed when I'm testing. I'll make the video. I'll put it up on my blog, just because it's easy enough to do that. And I'll be at a place with a box full of cable on Thursday. So look for that probably this weekend.
Nice. Now, what band are you setting up for on Thursday? Is this a band that, or is something else?
Oh, no, we're actually doing, so they've had a huge construction project up there this year, and they rebuilt the entire stage house up at Merriweather Post Pavilion. And we had the lower level ready for concert day, you know, back in late April, and they have been putting off the upper floor work up until now. And so now we've got to go back and do another walkthrough with our cabling guy and with the fiber guy and with the broadcast guy and walk through the upper level, you know, put on our high-vis vest and our hard hats again, and go walking through and plot out what our network's going to look like on the second floor of that building so that we can get that done this winter, along with a bunch of other stuff down at the venue. So we're really excited for that and for the upcoming new venue for that client that's going to open up this time next year.
Well, yeah. You're definitely going to add to that blog. Like you said, that will probably benefit a lot of people. It's nice to hear when you were describing this just now that I was following, and I can't remember who taught me this a few years ago, but I was following that kind of a guideline, especially at the end when you're holding those down and you do not want to let go so that they don't just get out of sorts when you slide them into the end and then crimp it wrong. But so it's good to hear that I'm at least doing that right.
So there's another tool if you really just don't want to deal with it, and it's called EasyRJ45. And the way that it works is that the end of the cable, so you know, you shove the wires into the connector, and that connector you kind of stops. This will let you actually slide it through. And then you can make sure that the cable, the pinout's correct before you cut off the end and then do the crimp. The connectors are a lot more expensive. They work out to be like 75 cents instead of about a dime a piece. But it's certainly a hell of a lot easier. And the standards, I'm trying to remember who makes it. Primus? Yeah, Primus. And they work just fine. They work great. It's just a question of whether or not you want to spend 75 cents on a connector or 10 cents. So if you really get good at it, great, phenomenal. If you only deal with it once in a blue moon and you just don't want to spend the time practicing, it's definitely a great way to get a cable. You can put it in the, you can have a thing done. It'll be in your kit, and you can be ready on a moment's notice.
That's pretty awesome. Just to round out my story, by the way, my friend has a second restaurant, and he just called me yesterday to come back to the second one because the electrician did the same thing in that spot.
Oh, man.
But it's, man, okay. Another tough free meal. It's going.
Yeah,
it's
more
good.
Free food,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I was going to say, is it good food, though?
It's excellent. He owns a great Italian restaurant in New York, so it's pretty sweet.
You got to really bring it if you're having a good Italian restaurant in New York. So
yeah,
that's the real business.
And as a side note from cabling, I actually just helped his mom at the house with a bunch of, you know, old computer clean out and helping with some junk mail issues. And I left with a case of wine. So you really can't go wrong with that.
Hey, you know, there's something to be said for really great clients that don't necessarily pay in cash.
Yeah.
I used to work for a restaurant over in Arlington. Sadly, they closed this year. But they had a 15-year run. So, I mean, they had a pretty good time. But I traded them web development for free lunch at the bar. And so essentially, whenever they changed the menus, they'd send me I'd come out, do photography of the whole new menu, put it up on their website, you know, do HTML menus, not just PDF menus. It was the best deal in town. I mean, we probably about broke even on that, but you know, I could probably just turn up once a week at the bar, have lunch. You know, I got to be really good friends with all the bartenders and all the servers and stuff. So it was really sad to see them close this year, but it was about their time. So
yeah, restaurants, they have it. They have the bartering system down like no other, man. On a given night when I'm there, it's like, hey, meet this guy. He's my plumber. This guy's my electrician. This guy's this. You know, they're all sitting there eating, and that he's got a sweet deal going for him.
The case of wine from the guy's mother, did that fall off the back of a truck there, Sam?
I don't mean to hijack this conversation off of cabling, but I just have to tell you guys one other really kind of crazy story about this. So years ago, I had done work with them. And again, I've known this family for years. I've known him since high school. And his father gave me a case of just assorted liquors this time. And they had dust on them and everything. I was like, wow, you just gave me whatever you don't use anymore. He's like, yeah, pretty much. So I took them home, and one day I had some friends over, and I opened up this one bottle for my friends, and they were like, oh, this is really good. And it was a Johnny Walker label, but not like the blue or the black or the red, and it was a liqueur. And someone decided to take a picture of the label and look it up. And as it turned out, it was a $1,200 bottle of alcohol. That was rare. It was made only for the New York area for a rare period, a short period of time. So
oh,
I was like,
amazing.
I was like, everybody, back in the bottle, cork it up. So I take it out on special occasions now, every once in a while.
Nice,
like celebrating a cabling job gone well.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so it's funny, you know, we were talking about, you know, previous cabling standards, and, you know, we think about the, you know, the cabling that we started with, which was all, you know, Cat 3 maybe, or, you know, if we're really back in the day, or if we end up with Cat 5, which has the four pairs. And then we end up with, you know, 100 base T, gigabit, and on, you know, upwards from there to 10 gig and 100 gig. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, you know, it's really interesting that we end up with a standard that ends up with data traffic over 1.2.3.6, which was what you could get away with for an old 10 base T cable, right? And so that's probably what, you know, maybe your electrician tried to pull off. But, you know, I mean, I think about all of the cables that I used to make, 1.2.3.6, and I was like, why did they pin it out that way? As opposed to 3.4.5.6, which would be all right next to each other, all right in the center, and then you could probably get away with a smaller cable connector. And then I remembered that the RJ45 standard jack, which is the plug that you see on the end of every Ethernet cable, is also jack compatible with the RJ11 phone standard, which is the, you know, standard phone cable like we see everywhere back to the day, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you think about a single line phone cable, where are those two pins? They're on 4 and 5. They're dead center in the connector. And so, I mean, if it's only got two connectors, those are 1 and 2, right? But if you plug an RJ11 cable into an Ethernet port, it's hitting port pins 4 and 5. Hmm. And we think about how phones used to work, right? I mean, still do work, at least for the most part. You're passing, what, 48 volts over that particular wire? So, I mean, you plug in for a 48-volt connection into your Ethernet switch, what's going to happen? Bad things, right? Right. And so at that point, that's why you've got 1.2.3.6 passing your data, so that if you do end up plugging a phone port into an Ethernet switch, you're not going to jam up every other, you know, connection on the box by passing voltage over those lines.
Because it makes perfect sense.
And so I was like, oh man, those guys were so smart. Those were real engineers. And I'm thinking, how many years did it take you to think about that, Thomas? How many years?
Well, the people who invented it probably had to fry a few switches before they sure. figured that one out. So that's a great intuitive kind of observation there. And I guess, so it gets at like thinking about this wiring a little bit more. You know, when we look at a cable, it's 8 wires in a row. So can you talk more about just the sort of the mechanics of that and what's actually happening on each of those individual wires and what the pairs are and how they work together for send and receive?
So, yeah, so you end up with, at least in terms of, you know, the Ethernet standard for, you know, 10 base T, again, we think about the old 10 base T standard, because it's easier to start there, right? And it's easy to think about that particular pinout. And we just mentioned that there's 1.2.3.6. And for a straight through Ethernet cable, the ends are the same, right? They're terminated the exact same way on both ends. And so it's passing, you know, two sets of data strands, 1 and 2, 3 and 6. And so there's a positive voltage and negative voltage, you know, in terms of how the switch handles that particular modulation of the bit stream that passes. And so it's, you know, packetizing, the switch packetizes your data. So it chops it up into a smaller bit stream so that you can receive individual frames of data that pass through. And so you've got that, you know, 1.2.3.6 pair, and they travel together through the cable. And then you get two other pairs as part of the Hunter Base T connection. And so then you get a third pair and you get a fourth pair that are doing the exact same thing. And they kind of sit in the middle and they sit on the other end. So they so your pairs are 1, 2, 3, 6, 4, 5, 7, 8. And so that is white, orange, orange, white, green, blue, white, green, white, orange, or white, brown, brown. And so if you strip the wires off of any Ethernet cable that's worth its salt, that's what those are what the colors are on the inside.
Is that A or B? Aren't there two?
So the A and the B are the terminations themselves, and what order they get terminated. The colors are the same, mm-hmm. no matter right. what. I'm pretty sure white, orange, orange, white, green, white, orange, white, green, blue, white, green, white, brown. See, it's a tongue twister.
you're good up until six, I think.
I just got to pull them apart and do it. So there are two standards, right? So we've always talked about 568A and 568B. And the government, if you're doing wiring for the government, it's got to be 568A because that matches the USOC code for what Ethernet is. A lot of places that use the old AT&T phone system used 568B. And I'm looking here to see what the pinouts are on 568A and B. Yeah, it's 568A starts with the green pairing. So it's white, green, green, orange, blue, white, orange. Or I'm sorry, it's white, orange, blue, white, blue, orange. This is going to drive the listeners crazy. I'm so sorry. I'm going to provide you guys documentation for this so that you can actually see what those pinouts are as you see. And so you can see that there are three pairs separated by a pair kind of over the top. And so you can see that that's there. And it just depends on which cable you put where. And so, 568A, it was going to say if you need a crossover cable, for example, if you've got a Ethernet jack that's not auto-sensing, so i.e. is a PC from like the mid-2000s or earlier, you need a crossover cable that switches the one end for the other. And so that switches the 1, 2, 3, 6 pins so that you get, so that 1, 2 on one end becomes 3, 6 on the other.
So that's if you're connecting one host directly to another, one computer to another computer without a switch or a hub.
Without a switch. Or you can do it without a hub may need it, mm-hmm. But a switch won't. A switch will be auto-sensing at this point. So yeah, if you've got a hub or if you're doing direct host-to-host communications, you need a crossover cable which splits the two.
That'll be great for your old gateway PC, Joe.
In the Mac Museum.
In general, we're using the same groupings for 568A and B, just in a different order. What's the reasoning really behind the two standards?
I think it has to do with the way in which a couple of different systems required those pinouts be done. The AT&T phone standard is the one that I think about, where it's doing data signaling over one channel, actual data throughput on the other. So I think about this with the old Lucent phone systems. If you ever walked into a business and seen a gray cabinet or an old beige cabinet, plastic cabinet that says AT&T on it or Lucent or Avaya, the really old Merlin Magics, the AT&T legends of the phone system world. That's how their pinouts were done. So you needed to do the pinouts correctly so that the phone would actually see the signal from the phone system to pick up. And so that's why you needed a 568B. You needed 568A if you were going to do any work with the government. So most buildings around DC are all 568A. And phone systems now are smart enough that they don't care whether something's wired 568A or B. One, because they're mostly voice over IP now, but I think that there was a patch at some point to make those work, but I'm not going to hold myself to that. I might be wrong on that.
So, not to go too deep on this, but I think for me it's at least beneficial. So, let's say you walk into an office building, small office, we won't go government or enterprise or anything like that, right? And their wiring inside the walls is all 568A. And you have a whole bunch of 568B patch cables for whatever reason. It shouldn't matter one iota, right?
No, it really shouldn't matter. Modern connection, modern Ethernet jacks aren't going to care.
Yeah.
And by modern, I mean made in the last 15 years. They're just going to handle that. Oh, that's a crossover cable. I got you. And then, handle it. So, 568A and 568B are kind of interchangeable these days. Yeah. So, I mean, what's really interesting, so if you've got a straight through connection, if you really require a straight through connection, you can't handle auto sensing, then you really are in trouble. But I would say that 568B is way more common than 568A, just because, you know, the government isn't big enough of a client to have say that the universal service order codes are how things work. And so, but I mean, if you're doing federal contracting, you got to run 568A period. But 568B, you know, was the old AT&T 258A pinout. So as far as AT&T was concerned, and as far as AT&T was concerned, you know, or as far as the world was concerned, AT&T was the 900-pound gorilla at the time. That was what you ran your cabling for. And so, you know, at least when I talk to our cabling vendor, if I'm going to talk to Josh about stuff and say, Josh, we're going to do this all T568, and then he says B. He's like, it's always B. It's never A unless you're a government. So
Tom, looking at how this all evolved, just kind of, you know, pursuing that a little bit further. So 10BASE-T used, I guess, two pairs, right? Four wires total, as you mentioned, 1, 2, 3, and 6. And then was it 100BASE-T that added, you know, the additional two pairs, so four pairs total using all eight wires?
No. So 100BASE-T can work off of four wires. It's the same structure. It needs to be, I think it's got to be Cat5e instead of just Cat5. I'm fairly sure on that. I'm going to have to Google that.
Is required for gigabit, but Cat5 is probably won't work with gigabit unless the runs are very short and it's, you know, high quality cable, I guess.
Let's see here. 5 versus 5E. The Category 5E specification improves upon the Category 5 specification by tightening some crosstalk specifications and includes new crosstalk specifications that were not present in original Category 5. See, the bandwidth of 5 and 5E is the same, so it's 100 megahertz connections. And the physical cable construction is the same, and the reality is that most Cat5 cables meet Cat5e specifications, though it is not tested or certified for that. Gotcha. So,
interesting. I guess my thinking on this is I've seen cases that seemed very similar to what Sam described, where there was a device that was plugged into a network drop that was working, and then they plugged in a, you know, piece of equipment that then didn't work. In my case, it was like a Sonos device that was plugged into a network drop. And I came into the client site thinking I'm just going to replace that Sonos with an AirPort Extreme and then plug in the Sonos to the AirPort, you know, in like as a bridge. And I found that the AirPort just wouldn't get a link. I could not detect a signal there.
That's really interesting. Because, yeah. I mean, that seems to me like a case where you've got, you know, one device that's auto-sensing and one device that's not, or you've got a place where, you know, the auto-sense fails. Because there's a chip that goes into each of the, you know, network interfaces these days called an MDIX. And, you know, the MDI was the old one. And that's the, I think it's media detection interface, something like that. Let's see if how crazy I am here. Medium-dependent interface, that's right. And so the medium-dependent interface or the media-dependent interface with crossover is the difference between an auto-sensing and a non-auto-sensing connection. And so if you had a device that's really sensitive to that negotiation process where it says, hey, can you talk at, let's say, gigabit full duplex? And it'll say, no, but I can do gigabit half duplex or 100 megabit half duplex or et cetera. And they just can't come to an appropriate negotiation over a period of time. The link light will never kick in. Right. And so essentially it'll never hot up at that point. And so you may have been able to fix that by forcing the port on the switch. If you've got a manageable switch, doesn't have to be a fully managed switch. Some of the smart switches will let you set individual data transmission rates. And I think here the Netgear ProSafe lines that are like 8 or 16 ports that are, you know, moderately managed. They have a web interface, but you're not going to do like heavy duty VLANs and stuff on there. Will let you actually auto negotiate or stop the auto negotiation process and just say, this is gigabit full duplex, just deal with it. Right. And so they should actually just handle that.
Now, in this case, I think if I remember correctly, this was a number of years ago. I think that on further inspection, I found that it was fewer wires actually inside the RJ45 connector. I think it was only four wires.
Right.
And so I guess my theory is that at this point now that the Sonos was able to do 10BASE-T, and I guess maybe the AirPort just refused to to yeah. do that.
I mean, it's possible you had a place where it would just refuse to negotiate. Right. And, you know, that refusal to negotiate generates a failure in the link light department. Right. So, I mean, you know, always check. I had a weird situation today. I was at a client. They were expanding their office a little bit. They were trying to double up on some offices. And so we threw some they use voice over IP phones, so we needed to power the phone that was going in there. And they didn't have the budget to run another $250 cable. So they spent $100 on a switch. And so we plugged in everything, got it all set up, and the phone would just not talk to anything. And I'm like, what is going on here? I just took this cable out of the box. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure enough, I had a bad cable. And it was a commercial cable. It should have been just fine. Thank you, Staples. I'll shout you out. Thank you, Staples. No, it was the client who brought the Staples cable. So, I mean, they didn't ask us what our recommendation was. And, you know, it's really interesting for just basic cable supply these days. Home Depot, man. Home Depot is hard to beat in terms of cost. Because you go in and it's like $2 or $3 for a short patch cord or $10 for, you know, like a 12 or a 15 footer. Which at least in terms of, you know, a markup isn't offensive the way that it is at like all the office supply companies.
Right.
Yeah, but they're not monster cables, so.
They're not gold-plated.
They are pure gold.
Right. My theory in Sam's case was that, you know, it wasn't limited to just four wires, but if you had like a couple of the wires that were just bad, maybe they just weren't, you know, conducting through, not that they were like marginal in quality, but just that they were simply like, you know, severed at some point along the line. Right. The device may have just considered it like a four conductor, you know, two pair cable, like only, you know, only two pairs of which were actually working, and therefore negotiate at 10 base T. And then, of course, again, the other, you know, the newer device just wasn't able to do that, I guess.
Right. Yeah. And it's very possible that, you know, that they just couldn't come to an agreement across the link layer. And that's kind of what you see at that point.
It's one of these things where it's a miracle it works at all.
You know,
it's like TeamViewer. Yeah. A miracle it works at all. Hey, Tom, to the average consultants that's listening out there, I mean, it's great to be as informed as you are, but obviously we all can't be. Would your advice be to partner up or to be on the lookout for a good cabling guy that you could bring in on projects and that's your go-to person? Is that normally?
Yes. Yeah. You know, we've worked with Josh Pace of Pace Communications here in the DC area for, gosh, 9 years now, 8, 9 years, something like that. And, you know, it comes to if we come to a job site and they're in Virginia or if they're in Maryland or if they're in DC, you know, we'll call Josh in because I want Josh to be involved with that because we met Josh on a job. We have a client that is their offices are really cool, but they used to be an 18th century barn. And so cable paths, not exactly built into their environment. And Josh was our client's wiring guy. And so, you know, we were like, oh my God, we got to get this guy's card because he's good. They had lathe and plaster walls and he was running cable through lathe and plaster walls without making a mess. And, you know, found some really creative cable paths to get Comcast into their suite because they at the time were with, you know, they had like a Verizon DSL, right? And we all know how good a connection that is. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, not that Comcast is all that much better, but at least it has a bigger upside in terms of speed. And he managed to get that cable. He ran it probably 190 feet in, you know, a really creative path to get us up and running on Comcast. And he did it in like 2 hours. It was crazy. And so we got Josh's card, and he's been our cabling guy ever since. And we work with him on big jobs and little jobs. And he's got a whole crew of guys that he can expand so that if we need to do, you know, a 200-person company's offices across multiple floors – you know, he's just there for us. We just know that Josh can get that done on time. And having somebody like that in your arsenal as a consultant is so important because you don't want the electrician doing the cabling. And I see that a lot. And they're like, okay, white, orange, orange, white, green, white, blue, blue, white, you know, and you end up with some spaghetti soup of cable. Cause nothing good happens when an electrician terminates your Ethernet for you.
No but good could come of it.
No so good true. Comes of it. But, you know, having somebody like Josh on our, you know, that we can call, that, you know, we can even bill through. And so, you know, he's our vendor for the job. He gives us a quote. We take a markup and pass it along to the client. And, or, you know, if we really like the client, we just let him deal with them direct. But only in the cases where we're pretty sure they're going to pay on time.
So while we're kind of in this pool of networking, we don't get a chance to talk about this too often. And I mean, obviously, Tom, you're a wealth of knowledge. So I'm going to go to you with this question. What is your general feeling on switches? I mean, when you need to, you know, big jobs, small jobs, what do you use? What do you buy from Amazon or B&H or something like that? What do you stay away from?
So TrendNet for a while had some decent gigabit green switches, and they had no lifespan whatsoever. And we got bit by that a couple of times where client needed a gigabit network. They didn't have a huge budget, so they were like $100 for a 24-port switch. And we could throw it out there totally unmanaged and just let it go do its thing. And by the third time through the RMA cycle and the person on the other end of the phone's getting cranky with us, we're finally like, okay, never again.
Can I just throw a counterpoint to that? On the other hand, I installed a couple of TrendNet 8-port power over Ethernet PoE switches. 8-port switches, 4 ports of which do PoE.
Yeah.
Installed them. It looks like my Amazon is telling me that the order was placed in 2012, March 8th, 2012, when I was moving into this office.
Nice.
And they've been up and running for that entire time. I have to knock on wood now.
You just jinxed yourself.
Yeah, I know, right? Exactly. Should not have mentioned that.
Don't mention the dates. But, we've dealt with a lot of stuff. There's very little stuff out there that I think is just hot garbage. When we got tasked with replacing a bunch of really, really ancient Cisco gear, we prepared a Cisco quote for the client, and then they had to pick up their jaw off the floor. Because for a site-wide upgrade to, just fast Ethernet. We're not talking gigabit here. We're talking 100 meg. Brand new Cisco switches for, I think it was like 12 switches in total. It was something on the order of like $14,000. This was 3 or 4 years ago, and with all the warranties and stuff like that. And we were just like, can we take another run at this with a different vendor? And so they said, yeah. And I had a long conversation with our purchaser. And we work with Ann Bacon. They used to be PC Connection. Now they're just Connection. She's up in the New England part of the world with y'all. She's marvelous. And so I sat down and had a long chat with her. I was like, this is what we need. I need a switch where I need a managed switch. I need a real VLAN. I need, all manner of, functionality in my switches so that I can have a rich topography. And I need PoE in some places, so I need at least some PoE ports. They don't all have to be PoE ports. And by the end of it, we were looking at the Netgear, what was it, FS728TP. There we go. FS728TP. And it was 12 ports of power over Ethernet, fast Ethernet, with gigabit uplink. And so we could essentially have a gigabit core that goes with all of that and rely on the 100 base T to go with it. Because at that point, most of what they were doing there was point of sale or general network. And so they really wouldn't have benefited a substantial amount from gigabit. And they have served us incredibly well. We just actually took them out of service 4 years later because we ran a bunch more fiber for them. And now we've upgraded to the bigger brothers of those switches, which is the M4300, M4100, something like that. And again, it's gigabit this time, but gigabit with PoE and 10 gig uplink. And, when they go to a 10 gig core switch in 2 years, we'll have enough bandwidth for them. They just need to replace the SFPs, the fiber modules that kind of hold the whole network together. But I got to say, Netgear's been marvelous for us. Their next day business support has really been stellar. We've only had to use it once, but there was a lightning strike involved, so the switch was kind of toasty. Surge protector didn't help in that case. So the surge protector blew too. Wow. But they covered it under warranty. They were great, and they've been really marvelous to deal with. They have a CLI. It's very similar to the Cisco IOS CLI. And actually, I'm going to put that out there. There's a really great book out there called Cisco Routers for the Desperate. And that was where I learned how to be, like a network admin back 10, 12 years ago when I was working in-house. And it was funny. I saw this book at the bookstore, and I was like, hey, That could come in handy on my next, field mission. And I'd go out in the field and, do client moves for my boss at the time. And that book was absolutely instrumental because it's written for laymen. And so if you don't spend a lot of time getting your Cisco certification or doing a bunch of other stuff like that, that's a huge place to start because it will introduce you to the Cisco IOS command line you know, world where you're doing like ifconfig and write run and, you know, setting up VLANs and setting up spanning tree port fast and a bunch of other, you know, things in that vein. And I can't recommend it enough. It's written for the layman. It's written kind of like, hey, your hair is on fire right now. Let's get you through this emergency and teach you some useful concepts on the way.
Nice.
And so it's got a second edition now because I don't think iOS has changed too much in the intervening 10 years, at least in terms of how the command line operates. But I'm a big fan of that command line interface. And Netgear has one that's almost exactly like iOS. And, you know, the other people I want to throw out a shout to is HP. HP's ProCurve line of switches are amazing. And if you've got a client with budget who just wants to buy switches and wants to buy switches that will never, ever die, or in case that they do, they have a lifetime warranty attached, the HP ProCurve line of switches is stellar.
Yeah, we tend to see a lot of 100 base T switches like that out there. Sure. Do you typically replace those if you have them at client sites?
Only if I need to. And you know, we think about it here. I tend to think about this is that remember that switches are not like Wi-Fi. Switches are a pure medium, which means you get if the other end can do 100 meg, then you should be able to do 100 meg to it entirely. There's no half duplex. There's no you know, shared medium at that point. So I mean, if they're primarily doing internet work, you can probably get away with a 100 meg switch. You don't have to replace it. If you're starting to see throughput issues or if there's not enough backplane to make a server environment useful, then you're going to need a gig switch, and that's an easy upgrade. Gig switches are not expensive. So, I mean, we've gotten down to the point where, a 24-port lightly managed PoE switch with, with 24 ports is, a couple hundred bucks? 400, give or take?
So in that one that you just described, what would you buy? What like, give me a brand name.
Oh, so, I mean, the two that we work with most often, Jerry wants names, and I will make sure that Jerry gets names.
If you talk ProCurve, you're in a much higher price point, right?
Oh, sure. You're in a much higher price point, but you also have you have the HP brand name to fall back on.
Right, of course.
And, you know, everybody thinks of Netgear, they think of the crappy old routers that you see everywhere. The ProSafe firewalls, the 8-port switches, that work just fine. They do the job, but they're not going to do it fancy, and they are not going to do it, you know, forever. So, I mean, we think about it in terms of, you know, what can we get away with? And so if you can get away with that in your budget, great. If not, then, you know, jump up to a Cisco or jump up to an HP ProCurve. Or if you've got the budget for a Cisco admin, buy Cisco. But, you know, I mean, the other options that are out there, I mean, obviously, if you're going to support disparate switches all over the place, I mean, you think about single pane of glass management, then start looking at Meraki. But, you know, the thing that always kind of bums me out about Meraki is that if you don't pay your license fee because you think you're done or you want to freeze your firmware at a current position because it's working just great, you're SOL and now you have a brick. And I don't think that's a fair way to sell networking gear. Routers, sure. Access points and switches, not really my jam.
Yeah.
So, I mean, routers need constant attention. We need new virus definitions, malware definitions, IDS and IPS definitions. These are the things that we rely on our routers for that require teams of engineers for. But I really think that you should be able to buy a switch in its current configuration because switching is dumber than dirt. This is not a complex operation, even when you've got multiple VLANs. VLANs obviously add a complicating factor, and they add complexity to your network and complexity to your management. But I don't think that we need a fancy dashboard for that most of the time. Now, there are a lot of people out there that that really love that, and I am all for that. If you want to see a huge single pane of glass, for your entire environment, access points, switches, routers, and we have a couple of clients that do it this way. And we like working with those clients. They're very, very easy to handle. But I kind of feel like in a lot of cases, your network should be set it and forget it.
You know, jumping back to your discussion about Cisco IOS and CLI interface on Netgear, I mean, I got thrown into the fire with HP, and now I'm a big fan. But like Jerry said, big price point there. But the other frustrating part that I see also is just that even if they're slight, the differences in the – interface in working with, let's say, Cisco or HP, or even I brought in a guy one time that was all Brocade, which I had never worked with before.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And, you know, just having to sort of relearn just to do some of the simplest commands on occasion can be frustrating. And I think that's why, like you were saying, in a way, I think, is, you know, it, you can pick, I guess, depending on your clients, they might have a different config because you walked into it, but pick a brand and kind of run with it and learn it, because you can really get yourself in like where you know a little about a lot of different brands.
Jack of all trades and master of none.
Master of none, yeah. In the case of HP, like I got thrown into this enterprise situation and I knew nothing about the interface there. And I grabbed the HP engineer and I made him sit with me for like 6 hours and just, you know, one-on-one, just tell me this, tell me that, tell me this again. And I just wrote everything down, you know, but it can be overly complicated. And I find a lot of those engineers, there's a web interface for a lot of those switches and they hate to use it. They use it.
A lot of those cases, the web interface is slow.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think here of the Cisco web interface, it's all Java for crying out loud. And so, I mean, Java. Java just bums me out. I don't ever want to see that. But, you know, I think about the Netgear interface, and Netgear interface for the most part is HTML and iframes. And it could be slow. And so going through initial state config for a switch, you kind of got to build a rhythm into it. And so when we were doing the new network for Meriwether this year, I had to sit down and kind of get in the zen of building a new switch and be like, okay, VLANs, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 20, 150, 170, 199. And then just okay, save, commit, you know, and then just get into the habit of, you know, then making the port structures for the Wi-Fi ports and for the uplink ports and the trunk ports that go along with all of that. And so it was just a matter of, because I knew that, you know, hitting save on those configs was going to take about 30 seconds. So I had to kind of figure out, okay, now what am I doing next? And I'm setting up the VLAN structures for these ports. And there's no question that Meraki's interface for doing all of those things is a hell of a lot easier than the one for Netgear. And if you value install time more than you value switches that don't turn on after their licenses are up, then that's definitely a great way to do it. And if you're a Meraki reseller, then hey, you're taking home a percentage of those license fees when they get renewed anyway. So, I mean, that's certainly one way to do it as a consultant. And I think that, you know, I think here of a couple of different people, Jonathan Spiva, who's been on your show a couple of times, who I admire a great deal, who, by the way, just got his CWNA. So congrats, Jonathan. I am really proud of you.
Wow.
He did that last week at the CWNP in New Orleans. That my friend Chris Daw also was at. Chris didn't take the exam yet. He's studying hard. He's going to do it soon, and I know he's going to pass.
CWNA is no joke, man.
It is no joke. Interframe spaces, man. I have dreams about interframe spaces, and they scare the crap out of me. The more that I learn about Wi-Fi, the more that I spend my time imagining the engineering and the time scales that are involved in these minute little transactions, the amount of reception that you're getting, that you're sensitive to, it's just... it blows my freaking mind. We're amazing as a species. This is one of those things that, like, if I had to point to as an engineering, you know, achievement of the human race, I would point at Wi-Fi and be like, we did that, kids. We did that. That is freaking amazing. Because we think about it, and, you know, we're down into the millionths and billionths of a second in terms of transmission times. And, you know, we've got to move these packets around on radio waves through walls, through glass, through steel. And, you know, it just works. And, you know, we think about Wi-Fi as something that's just an expectation now. And the fact that in 15 years we've gone – or 16 years, we've gone from, you know – 1 megabit connections to effectively, or not even 1 megabit connections. That's like the rated link speed, right? So it was really probably 500 kilobit, all the way up to probably 650 megabit, you know, raw speed. And that's just astonishing. So I take my hat off to all those Wi-Fi engineers. But
and to think it's all wasted on silly cat videos.
Hey, cat videos are never wasted, my friend. Cat videos are never wasted, fair especially enough. Not in this election year fair when point. I need a lot of cat videos just to make it through the day. But, you know, going back to, you know, I know that Jonathan and his team work on an entirely Meraki basis because it allows them to have one set of interfaces for their entire fleet of clients. And they can see wireless networks. They can see physical switches. They can see routers. They can see everything throughout, you know, full client transparency in a single pane of glass. And that's got a huge amount of value. If I want to go in and make, you know, if I want to add a VLAN to a switch at Meriwether, I've got to go in onto every switch that needs it. And, you know, that's a bigger pain in the ass. So that requires a bunch of logging into disparate web interfaces or different SSH sessions and, you know, doing the needful to make sure that that gets done.
One thing that just occurred to me, Tom, is thinking all this stuff through, speaking of those lightly managed Netgear switches, for example, as the Internet of Things kind of wakes up and turns its sights on, you know, DDoS attacks and things like that, do you think it's pretty important to change the default password for some of these switches we just plug in and don't think twice about?
Yes, it's important to do that on every device you put into your network. No device should ever have its default password.
Do you think most people take that into consideration? I mean, most laymen don't change a router password, let alone, you know, a switch.
Right.
But even as a consultant, I find myself, you know, like having to remind myself that a switch, you know, it has some sophisticated stuff going on. It's not just sort of, you know, neutral, you know, dumb appliance. It's something with, as you mentioned, a web interface, even the very sort of, you know, cheap Netgear, you know, lightly managed ones, let alone fully managed switches. They have some stuff going on in there. So I guess it should be a habit to configure and at least just change the default password and probably update the firmware.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm a big fan of that exact combo. Anything that comes out of a box from, you know, Connection or Amazon or anybody, you don't know necessarily, A, how long it sat on that shelf before it got to you, and B, whether or not it was interfered with in the process. And I don't mean to get all conspiracy theory, but I mean, I do live 30 miles from Fort Meade, so I won't say that doesn't cross my mind once in a while. And, you know, we always make sure that the firmware's been replaced and it's the most up-to-date firmware. And, you know, that there's a password on there that's not the admin, that's not the published default. Because, I mean, if you look at the attack that took down Brian Krebs's site, Brian Krebs, internet researcher, super awesome guy, used to write for the Washington Post, but covers internet security issues as well as cyber crime, cyber theft, all of that cyber stuff. He had a site take down, you know, a DDoS attack of Internet of Things devices take down his site. They were at one point doing 600-odd gigabit per second of traffic. It was immense, a huge amount of traffic. Most of those from devices that never had their default password changed. And I might have one, and you might have one, and the listeners might have several. And, you know, we owe it to ourselves and we owe it to our clients to always to change the passwords on those devices. And then to update our notes and our documentation, especially in Luis's monkey box. So,
And tell everybody, Tom, what devices were primary in causing the attack on him.
I think if a memory serves, it was a bunch of webcams, if that's right.
Absolutely. You can see screenshots on his website. It's all webcams that took him down.
Yep.
Amazing.
So there are a couple of websites out there that will actually, you know, that act as like public repositories of data. And you can just go say, show me all the webcams that don't have passwords on them right now. And it will just scan you through a new one every 5 seconds. And you can just see what's on the webcam. So, I mean, that's really creepy. And
it really is.
It's not okay.
And, couldn't the people who write these sites use their powers for good and not evil and like actually just go in and change the passwords or something?
They possibly could. I mean, that's probably that actually might be considered a crime. If you think about the way the standard's written, that could be considered a crime entirely. So.
Great, Joe. You just suggested a crime on air.
It was probably not the first time.
Yeah.
We need David Sparks back on the air to protect me.
By the way, thanks for doing that episode with him. He's marvelous, and the points that he makes are excellent with regard to protecting yourself and your business.
No, he was a real treat. It was like getting to play a little basketball with somebody from the NBA. It was fun.
Yeah.
So, Tom, since the last time you were here, you've been a real, real busy guy, and I am a big fan and a big listener of the Mac Admins podcast. So I want you to start at the beginning. And tell us all about it. And anybody who's not listening already, shame on you. But this is a great chance for you to catch up on the episodes and listen in. So what can we find on the Mac Admins podcast?
You can head out to podcast.macadmins.org. And that's our website where you can find our URL. There's a subscribe link in the upper right-hand corner that will take you to our Libsyn stream. And you can copy that into your favorite podcast client. Leave us a review in iTunes, because that's what everybody tells me to tell everybody to do. And, you know, it's been a really good group of people. I started by having this conversation with Adam Kudiga from up Swipely. And or is it Upserve now? I forget. It's one of those, as well as Charles Edge. And Charles and I got to talking at the bar at the hotel at Macaduck in London in February. And we're like, you know what? We could there's room for another podcast out there. And I had a really good time when I was on your show. And I was like, you know, this might be fun to do again. I did radio in college. I've got a voice. I've got a face for radio.
You got the pipes.
I got the pipes. So I figured, you know, it would be a good thing to do. And so we started kind of putting the call out. Hey, who else would like to be on? And so Emily Kosolik, who's now at Retail Me Not, she's speaking at Mac Sysadmin in Göteborg right now. She's marvelous. And she's been an excellent voice of sanity for us. We also have Marcus Ransom, who was for a while at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. And he was running the Mac department for the largest Mac installation in Australia and is now doing his own thing down in Australia. So if you need somebody down in Australia, I strongly recommend Marcus Ransom. Jason Miller was instrumental. He's at Thumbtack. You know, then also the support of John Kitzmiller from macadmins.org and Dana Campbell from Slack, who were really just instrumental in getting us up off the ground and being supportive while we kind of launched our podcast. We're 11 episodes in now. We've got a 12th one in the can that's getting edited right now by our awesome mixing engineer, who's Aaron Lippincott. I've kind of been acting as the producer and handling some of the booking and the editing of the podcast itself. I've learned a lot about logic. I've learned that microphones are really, really sensitive beasts, and you got to be careful, and you can't do your laundry while you do your podcast. But it's been a lot of fun, and we've talked to a lot of really interesting people. Charles is always a wealth of knowledge. Charles is the director of professional services at Jamf Software. They make Casper, which you may have heard of. Let's see, what have we done? Who have we had on recently? We had Joel Rennick on. Joel Rennick was a consultant like all of us once upon a time, and then went to work for a certain fruit company in Cupertino. He was based all over the world for them and was doing a lot of stuff for their professional services group, and has now come back out of the fruit company. And he's been working on a really cool, it's kind of AD without AD, and it's called Nomad. And we just had him on recently to kind of talk about a bunch of the challenges that were associated with Active Directory, with maybe not wanting to bind to directory services anymore, but still getting some of the benefits of talking with directory services. So things like 802.1x identity certificates designed to let you talk to a wireless network without ever putting a password in. And so that's, you know, one of the things that he was really keen on, as well as, you know, just a basic login structures that will let you authenticate to all of those lovely SAML services that we deal with on a regular basis, whether that's Google or Office 365 or Okta or OneLogin, you know, and some things like that. We had Shelley Watson on talking about testing culture, and that was really a whole lot of fun. And we also had Tim Sutton and Patrick Fergus on to talk about Adobe. When Adobe released their new package updater format, they, you know, for a long time the RIBS package format was kind of the way that they did everything, and it was kind of a giant pain in the ass to deal with everything. So, you know, it was definitely a place that you know, we wanted to get a lot of people on that were knowledgeable in the Mac admin community that wanted to come talk deep tech dives on various subjects. During WWDC, we talked to a couple of people at WWDC. We talked to Rich Troughton, who's at Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and Harold Monohart, who is the head of their Mac department at SAP in Germany. And so we got to grill them on, hey, what did you learn today? What did you talk to people about? How did this whole process work? What did you do? And it was really great to get a live report directly from there. Eric Dreher was on as well.
Particularly enjoyed the show that you had with Eric. I also enjoyed the live video feed that you did when the new iPhones came out.
Yeah,
that was a lot of fun.
That was a lot of fun. We're going to try and do that again more often, probably around some of the Apple events. So I'm hoping we're going to do one by the end of the month, hopefully with brand new hardware from Apple. I know I'm dying for a new MacBook Pro, and so is my business partner. So we're both kind of, you know, I think Mark's got a 2012 MacBook Pro that's very much at the end of its life. I'm on a 2013 that's kind of starting to have battery issues. So
I mean, I can't tell you how many people, I mean, we talk about it on the show, we talk about it off mic. I mean, you run into people everywhere, professionals, people who are just your clients out there. Everybody wants a new Mac portable. And I think when this thing drops, I think it's going to just be off the hook because they've waited so long.
That's the other thing that kind of worries me is whether or not if we get our order. And that's one of the things that we're working on with our clients right now is building a hardware list so that we've got, okay, who needs a new Mac right now? So that when we drop, we can try and get our orders in first day so that we're at least part of the first, second or third wave of hardware to deliver.
Yeah, I can't imagine they're going to be able to satisfy the need. But getting back to the podcast, I just think it's a great resource out there. And there's so many different facets of what we do. In some ways, we like to think of ourselves here at Command Control Power sort of like the everyman podcast, you know, the simple caveman yeah. kind of thing. I love listening to you guys because I love those deep dives. There's so much room. I mean, there's probably room for five more podcasts. And we
I totally agree. Yeah. If you're out there thinking, hey, I want to do a podcast, do it. Do it, do it, do it. Pick up a microphone. You don't need a spendy mic. We have recorded with, you know, people in, you know, iPad, you know, Apple earbuds for crying out loud. And the audio sounds good enough. And so if you want to get out there, just start doing it. Don't just say, well, I need to learn. The only way you're going to learn is by doing. And so hop up there, get a mic, find somebody to talk to, and just start chatting on the and hit record on Skype. You know, if you got GarageBand on each of your machines and you start recording in GarageBand or Audacity or anything like that, start doing this. It's a lot of fun. And lining up guests is always a challenge. The producer's job is not easy. And so I just want to say, one, thank you guys for leading the way for so long. You know, you guys are really pillars of the community. You give back so much to consultants like me, consultants like your listener base. It's so valuable to have you guys out there. So thank you.
Thank you too, Tom, for being a guest frequently on our show and contributing now with the Mac Admins podcast. I mean, I just think that the Mac community is just so generous in so many different ways. With the podcasting, I think Sam and I have Joe to thank for being the impetus to get the show on the rails and to start putting out shows. But then the challenge is to be consistent about it. One of the things that really always disappointed me when I was a regular listener back in the day to maybe somebody like Merlin Mann or something like that is when the show would drop and there'd be like a week would go by. You know, so we struggle with that. Just speaking. Yeah, you know, we try to move our schedules around to accommodate and at least wave the flag every week. It's like visiting with a friend. You kind of count on it after a while. And we struggle, but we
keep us on point, Jerry. And to his credit, that's the reason why we've been like clockwork over time.
We're fighting with Joe's vacations because like Joe's probably, Joe's probably due for a vacation right about now, right, Joe?
It's been a couple weeks. Yeah, seriously. Yeah. So. Tom, thank you so much for joining us on Command Control Power yet again. And I'd like to also take this opportunity to thank our patrons, those who support the show and contribute financially. We really, really appreciate it. And if you want to become one of our patrons, you can sign up at commandcontrolpower.com and click on support. And I'd like to thank specifically the patrons who pledge at the level where they'd like to also hear their name on the air every month when we do our live show, and I'd encourage listeners to check out their sites, some of which are really interesting if you're looking, like Jerry did recently, to redesign your own site. There's a lot of great sites out there, so give our listeners some traffic, give our patrons some traffic. Thank you to Jonathan Spiva of 74-Bit, J.D. Strong of Strong Solutions, Daniel Escobar of Proactex, Craig Cabus of Mac Pro Consulting, Jonathan Nieves of Exceed Technology Group, Matt Waschuk of Nine Bark Consulting, Dennis Nolan of Cirrus Partners, and Weldon Dodd of Rewind Technology. Thank you all for contributing, and also thank you to those who have contributed and requested to be anonymous. We love you as well. Thank you all out there for listening and supporting us week after week. We really appreciate it.
I love the unlock on Sierra with your Apple Watch. It's working great for me.
I got to get on that Sierra, you know?
What is that? Is that the latest operating system by the Apple people?
The Fruit Company, yeah.
The Fruit Company, yeah, okay.
Everyone pining for the new MacBook Pro yet to be released. I'm on a mid-2012 11-inch MacBook Air, so.
No, you're not the only one.
Is that the same model you're rocking there, Jerry?
Yeah, I'm wearing through the keys now. The light's coming through the key. All kinds of key wear on it.
I still don't understand that size.
11-inch MacBook has deteriorated to the point where its battery's useless, and we've replaced it once already, and it's clearly starting to be a logic board issue. So she's kind of moved over to a 13-inch MacBook Pro that we had in our loaner pool, and I know she's desperate. She's been really interested. She's starting a new web design business, and so we're just like waiting at this point. It's like, come on. Let me click the button. I've got the money ready.
Yeah, exactly. Any day now.
Now, I'd love a Mac, a new refresh on Mac Mini with a quad core. I'd replace the one I have here in the office.
So do you guys roll with stickers on your laptop, or am I the only weirdo that does that?
Junior Tech made some groovy CCP stickers.
Yeah. Homemade command control power stickers, which are, I'm just preparing the list of names. And speaking of our patrons, it's just kind of an added bonus giveaway. What did you call it, Jerry?
Premium?
Premium, yes. Thank you. for some of our patrons, and we only have enough for the first dozen or so until we hand make some more. So pretty neat. Handmade by my Junior Tech, who's now off at college.
I lobbied really strongly for the tote bag, but they voted me down. Wouldn't that be nice, Tom? You could go into your client with a handsome tote bag?
Yeah. That'd be pretty slick. I mean, I'd take a tattoo, though. I want like a temporary CCP tattoo that I can just wear on my wrist and be like, yeah, dog.
Temporary.
Yeah, why temper?
So tell us about the stickers you have. Typically don't do stickers. What do you have on your laptop?
I'm rocking a Watchman sticker that I got from Alan.
Those are nice.
Yep.
When I went to one of the events where he was at. And then I have a Slack sticker. I have a GitHub sticker that I got at PSU Mac Admins this year. And then I got a Mac Brain sticker from Andy Seago.
Oh, you know what I would love? I'd love a Robot Cloud sticker.
Oh, they have really cool stuff.
Oh, I love that stuff. They're not listening, but I don't think they're listening. But if you're listening, Robot Cloud, we would love some, and we'll send one to Tom if you send it to us, or vice versa.
You got it, man. I will happily put that on my laptop. I love cool logo gear. In the process of evaluating some T-shirts for the Mac Admins podcast, so when that happens, we'll definitely let you guys know.
Yeah, I saw you tease that out there, and then it went quiet. So I was I wanted to order that day.
We got to figure out how to actually do the money thing, because I mean, it's weird. So I mean, we're the Mac Admins podcast, but we're not really like set up yet to take ads or to do Patreon or to do T-shirt sales, because you know, we got to have like a business entity that goes with all of that. And so we should have something to report on that before the end of the year.
Alan Hancock says that there's going to be Watchman monitor stickers at the Mac Tech conference. So look for those. Are you just going to keep it?
We're keeping Tom on for this riveting discussion.
Yeah, right? This is behind the scenes here.
Tom, thanks for joining us, man.
Hey, thanks, guys. Appreciate you so much. Have a wonderful evening.
Yeah. Has Charlie ever bit your finger? I just need to. I just need to ask that.
Not yet.
Okay. All right. Let me know.
Yes, I will, definitely. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks again, Tom. Take
care. Later.